This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not. Well, David, when you think detective, do you think capable, organised and assertive?
Not always. Eccentric, chaotic, yeah.
Some of these characteristics are in the detective in the Paradise Heights miniature railway bust-up by Kate Solly. Well, welcome, Kate, and thank you for making me laugh.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's so good to be here.
Fleck Parker is a detective, and this is not her first case. There were others. Tuesday evenings with Copetown Craft Resistance and the Paradise Heights Craft Store Stitch Up. Perhaps you can give some background to Fleck Parker.
Right, so Fleck's a school mum. She has a little boy in prep and a very opinionated toddler and a baby who she's still feeding. And so her life's very busy and a bit chaotic, and she loves a good puzzle. And in the Paradise Heights craft store Stitch Up, she discovered that the thing that she likes to do as a hobby that's just for her and not about being a mum is solving crimes.
I love the way that you've described that, or Fleck has, that it's like a physical jigsaw. And she keeps her everything book. So what's in her everything book?
Her everything book is a notebook. It's a bit like some people have bullet journals. It might be a little bit like that. It's a book where she writes her shopping lists, her meal plans, and all the notes from her cases and just everything she needs to have in her, all her life admin and all her case notes are all in this one book.
And meal plans. And I just laugh about this one, and you will too, reader. And the laundry wall serves as her control room.
That's right.
Now, as the mother, she has to handle her son, as you said, to and from school, daughter Nora, a kinder, and baby Alice, night feeds and crawling. Detectiving is her hobby. Her husband, Matthew, what's his hobby?
Oh, Matthew loves systems, and he loves trains. And so there is a miniature railway near them where he volunteers regularly, and he loves to set the signals and set new routes and things like that because he just loves.
He's also been made the quartermaster, but he can't reconcile the accounts.
That's right.
Thankfully, there's video surveillance there, though.
Absolutely. And he needs someone to have a look into it, and Fleck needs a new case. And so it's a match made in heaven. He gets Fleck on the case, and she needs to have a look and see, why are things going missing?
Other volunteers at this railway include the president, Sidney Tozer. What's the similarity here with him and Thomas the Tank Engine?
Well, everyone calls him Topham after Sir Topham Hatt, the Fat Controller, because, look, he's portly, but also he sort of looks a bit, you know, with his bald head, he looks a little bit like the Fat Controller, but also he does like to control things as well.
And possibly in more things than just the railway.
He has that sort of personality.
A young man, Quinn, and here's a quote, "He was tall in the way that gave the impression that the rest of his body was still catching up, a confusion of jutting shoulders and knees and wrists and elbows." He was the engineer who is really only animated when talking about trains. And I'm going to ask Kate Solly to read a little bit about trains.
By the end of the conversation, Fleck had made little progress investigating Quinn, but had learnt much about the Faulknerhurst train, the Eltham Trestle Bridge, and that time in the 90s when an empty Metropolitan train accidentally rolled downhill along an entire train line all the way from Broadmeadows to Flinders Street Station. "You should start your own podcast," Fleck said. By now, they had moved across to the kitchen area and were sitting on the stools by the bench. Quinn gave a small smile. "That's what my girlfriend says," he said.
So did that really happen?
Oh, yes.
This train just rolled from Broadmeadows all the way down.
Oh, it's the best. It's the best story. There's my kids, I have train nerds in my family, and they showed me some of the best YouTube videos. Tate Set is the creator who did this video, and it happened. If you look it up, this train, they hadn't put the brake on properly and they'd turned the train off. So there was no, because the train had been powered down, there was no dead man's stop that you'd usually have. And it just rolled downhill. And it was sort of before mobile phones were really used a lot, so they couldn't sort of call and see if anyone was on the train. They didn't know if anyone was on it. It rolled downhill, because it's downhill all the way from Broadmeadows to, I think it was Flinders Street. I can't remember, but I'm pretty sure it was Flinders Street. And then it ended up crashing into an empty train. And so the train got damaged. No one got hurt, I don't think, but just this is train history. I know. I was fascinated. I had no idea.
But. Well, when you have a miniature train, you also have miniature buildings and things around. Mm, and there's an artist, Ruby, who is creating a miniature village. And she has a YouTube series of stop motion videos. Now, down the track, Fleck also unlocks the mystery of why Quinn is wanting money so desperately and why Ruby is stealing envelopes. And we also learn what a bogey and a mother sucker are. But there's a new volunteer, Nathan Garland.
Oh, Nathan.
What's he trying to do?
Nathan, look, Nathan is here to charm you. He wants your vote. Nathan wants your vote, and he is here to. He is your number one candidate for Ashthorne, and he is going to, you know, change. He's got a lot to do. He's going to clean up government. He's got, you know,
he's got a big
absolutely
job.
Oh,
but he wants your vote first. Is Fleck impressed by him?
Oh, Fleck is very much not impressed by Nathan. She does not trust him. She does not trust charming rich men. So this was, she's very much offside by him.
It's those in many hand society craft shop that Fleck is impressed by. Mm. This shop is set up to help single mothers find affordable long-term rental, a drop-in centre for women in crisis, and various programs to assist asylum seekers and refugees. Trixie is the new manager. How did Fleck meet Trixie?
Well, Fleck and Trixie are both school mums, and when Fleck first started out at the school, she was finding it a bit awkward and finding it hard to gel with some of the other school parents. She didn't watch reality TV and she couldn't really keep up with their conversations. Trixie's a total oddball and they clicked right away. They became really close when Fleck cleared Trixie's name, when Trixie had been accused of stealing money in the first book of the series. Trixie had been accused of stealing money, and spoiler alert, Fleck clears her name in the end. But that's how they bonded, and they get along really well. And their sons are friends too, so they both have boys in prep.
There's also Ranveer, the serious accountant, who has been pulled out of his isolated office and life to help with financial statements and suspicious bookkeeping. Mm. He is now helping to set up a not-for-profit microfinance scheme. Trixie's first idea was a Monday craft group, and Fleck brings in crochet that she's pretty useless at.
Yep.
Karen, jewellery making, Joe, the knitter, and Dimmer, the cake maker. Mm. Into the supportive group comes Lynette with her colouring book and a desire to talk about Gelvita. I think you better give us some background about Lynette.
Yes, well, Lynette is living her best Gelvita life. It's absolute, you know, Gelvita will change your life. It'll help you lose weight. It will help you with any ailment you might have. You just need to get a starter pack and recruit some people, and you will be making money, and you will go up the different tiers until you are, you know, you might even have your own car that you'll have to rent, but you'll have your own car. And it will be amazing. You will be living your best Gelvita multi-level marketing life.
And if you make mini muffins with Gelvita, what will happen?
Oh, well, there are all manner of help. Well, the fat will just roll off you. And it is just these, you know, Trixie might say nobody wants your laxative cupcakes, Lynette, but it's it is, she doesn't understand the Gelvita way.
Well, this is a quote. Gelvita, holistic health solution. There are all sorts of miracle benefits to these health gels. They can help with psoriasis, migraines, PMT, and autism.
Oh, autism. Totally cure autism.
And you can make money by becoming a consultant.
Oh, yes.
In contrast to all Lynette's girl boss and out there, chat, Fleck doesn't have the confidence to call herself a detective.
That's true. There's that imposter. And I should say on the radio, I'm very much tongue-in-cheek about the curing autism. That is not... Lynette thinks that's true. I don't think that's a good thing. I would never want to cure autism. Anyway, yes, Fleck has this imposter... these imposter thoughts of how can I even call myself a detective? How do I even get a job as a detective? And it's just that awkward being able to name, like many of us have, like we're talking on a writing podcast, being able to say, am I a writer? Do I get to call myself a writer? If you take a lot of what I write about Fleck solving crimes is very much about me as a mum trying to find time to be a writer. If you swap detective work for writing work and, you know, detective problems for plot problems, that's me. I even have the laundry wall.
Well, detective knows her way around media platforms. So she has to have false profiles. Maybe a writer does too.
Well, I've never done it with false profiles before, though sometimes I think that would be useful. I definitely find it is helpful. I was actually talking with Mary Lou Stevenson recently about her latest book, and she had said that she was writing about the Hobart West Point Casino, and she got onto a Facebook group of past workers there, a community group of them, and she said that was just a wealth of information, being able to talk with them and hear their stories. And so, yeah, definitely Facebook community groups and that can be a great source of things. But I don't think I've ever done it with a false profile before. I should get onto that.
It helps you infiltrate interest groups. Through the book, we get a dose of gaslighting and catfishing. Now, these are terms that I understand. But there was AITA posts I hadn't come across.
I'm a little obsessed with AITA posts. I don't know if you've heard of them. Swear word alert. They actually stand for, am I the asshole? And so you ask the question, look, I just did this. Am I the one at fault? In the book, because she's talking to some very polite women, Fleck fudges it and says, oh, it stands for am I the antagonist? Because she doesn't want to swear in front of them. But there are so many of them. And often it's to do with housemates or things like that. Like, he said this, she said this. Am I the one at fault, or are they the one at fault? Or are we both the ones at fault?
There's also a very interesting way of dealing with negative comments on social media, but we're not going to go into that because that is so clever. Your own bio at the beginning of this book, Kate Solly, doesn't proclaim your skill as a writer, but a mother of six and really good at getting the bubbles out of plastic book wrap, while most of your time is spent finding lost shoes and investigating what's making the car smell bad. That's right at the beginning. So I knew I was in for a humorous read, and I wasn't wrong.
Oh, thank you.
It starts very early on. An example, breakfast time on a school morning, Fleck and Trixie are caring mums, but they don't read the school newsletter, and they find out that the school is having its 100-year celebration. How do they cope?
I know. The little preps have to dress up as 100-year-olds. And they need quickly dig through the dress-ups bag. How do we dress them like 100-year-olds? And the toddler wants to dress as Batman. And it's just, it is a lot. It is a lot going on.
But in contrast, there's one boy dressed as...
Oh, that's right.
Super senior.
He is not buying into all this ageist nonsense.
It was just lovely. And, of course, there's the surprise chicken.
Oh, yes. I've cooked surprise chicken before. This is one of the notes on the meal plan. Surprise chicken, you just get everything in the fridge that's only got an inch left in the bottle, and you tip it all in to marinate the chicken. It could be quite risky, but you just make it work and then you bake it in the oven, and it's different every time.
The success of the miniature railway is being sabotaged. Observant mother Fleck Parker is asked to find out who could possibly be doing this in Kate Solly's warm-hearted The Paradise Heights Miniature Railway Bust-Up. Just an absolute delight. Thank you very much, Kate Solly.
Thank you so much for having me.
And sounds like a mental health issue, which sort of is a segue into my book with Anne Buston, Graham Simsion, about the General Hospital and psychiatry. First, there was the glasshouse, then there was the Oasis, and now we have the General Hospital, where authors Anne Buist and Graham Simsion continue revealing the challenges faced by psychiatrist Dr. Hannah Wright. So, Anne, Graham, welcome back to 3CR.
Great to be back for part three.
Absolutely.
Now, I want to draw a thread between all the three novels. What's the medical journey that Hannah Wright has been on, and where has she ended up?
So Hannah is training as a psychiatrist. So she's still in her 20s, and she's got a lot to learn. So in the glasshouse, we see her in the acute psychiatry ward. Then we see her in the community. Now in the General Hospital, she's doing something called consultation liaison psychiatry. And this is that interface with psychiatry and general medicine.
Well, Graham, I think the tone of this novel is slightly different to the others. I mean, I was overwhelmed by the challenges Hannah faced in the first novel, but there seems to be a more nuanced exploration here. Would that be a fair evaluation?
I look at the reactions from readers, and they certainly do find the stuff in the first two novels, which we were looking, particularly in the first novel, in The Glasshouse, we're looking at the hard end of psychiatry, of acute psychiatry, of the emergency medicine at psychiatry. So you're seeing really hard, focused mental illness. Whereas what we're seeing in this third book is physical illness first, but there's a mental illness overlay on that, perhaps because they already had a mental illness that didn't go away, perhaps because whatever problem they've got, and perhaps they've had a cancer diagnosis they're not coping with well, or possibly because nobody knows what's going on and maybe it's mental.
One of the things that comes through for me is a sort of cultural stereotyping. Stereotypes don't come from nothing. And if we can use that to be sensitive and alert clinically, in the territory, the Indigenous alcohol abuser is a stereotype, but it reflects a real problem, not just with First Nations people. When I worked there, I was always on the alert for fetal alcohol syndrome. But there's a big downside to those generalisations. When I walk into a ward, my name badge is the only thing stopping other staff from asking what I'm doing there. So those stereotypes seem to be an aspect that is constantly coming up in this novel. People are being categorised, but we can't diminish the stereotype. So that one about fetal alcohol syndrome, it's inappropriate in general society to comment on Indigenous issues of that nature and make assumptions, and yet they're a very real concern. How does a psychiatrist address that, Anne?
Look, I think it's something we've always got to be aware of, our own biases, society's biases. We've got to look at the patient in front of us and who they are. But you have to be aware of risk factors as well. And we want to explore all those things in this book and try and, as much as possible, put both sides of the story. What the problems like John, the Indigenous doctor, had by looking Indigenous, the sort of, you know, really negative stuff that he has to encounter all the time. But then on the other hand, you don't want to miss something that's obvious. And so you don't want to ignore things.
Well, we've got a case here of Junji, a Chinese gymnast and diver, who's a suicide risk. But here's a brilliant line. My parents came to Australia for me when I was 11. So he's almost culturally forced to succeed.
Yeah, look, I think it's important, Anne, as we explore these ideas, we don't take a position. But the complexity here is, do you take cultural issues into account to alert you to a possible diagnosis? And John, the Indigenous man, is saying, in the Northern Territory, we know we have an alcohol abuse problem, not just amongst Indigenous people, and therefore we're perhaps a little more alert to fetal alcohol syndrome. But then he says the other side of the story is that sort of stereotype is the one that has them saying, what's this guy doing in the ward?
But one of the most complex is Ishani. She's Indian, but she's a burns victim. But how does a psychiatrist unravel what could be, in fact, bride price and retribution and dowry and independence, or just being a suicide risk anyway? How does a psychiatrist deal with that?
Well, I think the first thing we're learning all the time, and Hannah is only in her 20s. She's not Indian. So she seeks out some cultural kind of knowledge from those around her. And we have a lot of Indian psychiatrists, so she doesn't have to look very far. But also as part of that, you know, just the issue of domestic violence. And that's not Indian-based. That can be anywhere at all. So it's making sense. And again, it comes down to the specific patient sitting in front of you, not judging, not prejudging, but making sense of what we're being told.
We've had a couple of sensitivity readers here. In fact, Dr. Manjula O'Connor, a psychiatrist, is an activist in this area. She was our sensitivity reader for this part, for Ashani's arc. Likewise, Donna Stolzenberg, who was a Victorian of the Year a few years back, on Indigenous issues, sensitivity reader. So on the one hand, we want to put some controversial things on the page. On the other hand, we want to make sure that they are authentic in the context of the communities in which they're presented.
Yeah, but they're very realistic in that regard. There are things that have to be unpacked. But we even get what is a very fundamental one, the gender divide. We have a pregnant Christina and we have the male doctor, Marcus, but he's actually had to make a professional decision to save Christina's life, even though Christina's birth plan was for a natural birth. So even male-female divide is problematic, Anne.
Yeah, and I think this is a really common one, and it doesn't have to be a male obstetrician, because there's just this wide difference between expectations and the reality of what obstetric hospitals can deliver, particularly when they're understaffed. I mean, we've had a couple of family members have babies recently, and the pressure on the staff was so obvious, and the beds, of getting them out quickly because there's more people coming in.
And there are professional questions like, we have to save the patient's life or the baby's life or whatever. Mm. You've got to make a professional decision which doesn't necessarily cater for the emotional.
I have to say you're presenting a very nice picture of the obstetrician. He's a jerk.
he is a jerk, but there is that conundrum there that exists. But in moving on, Anne, you've given us a greater insight to Hannah's development. There's another iteration of what she's going through. Previously, we learnt how Hannah's life was affected by her parents taking in foster children, and there was one child in particular, so listeners are going to have to go back and read that. But you've gone back one generation further now to Hannah's parents. We can't give it away, but what seems to be suggested is how much of our outlook is determined or accounted for by the way we were raised by our parents.
Absolutely. Intergenerational kind of transmission of all sorts of things, not just genetic, but because we're driven by the things that happen to us. And the things that happen to us affect us. And how that plays out is what we wanted to show on the page through the generations.
But how does an individual address their upbringing?
Well, I think we try to show that a bit. I mean, Hannah came from this house where there were 52 foster children, and she had a family that would tend to squash down the behavior, you know, why am I doing this or what's going on. So she did psychiatry in part to make sense of what was happening in her early life, and I think that's not an uncommon thing.
But Hannah's brother is acting out, so he's taken a different path.
Yeah, and of course we find he has a bit of a different background to Hannah, which they didn't even know about. So it all starts to make sense. And usually, as I'm teasing out and getting to know families, people don't always react in exactly the same way because there's an interaction between parents, circumstances, and the genetics you come into the world with.
Well, that brings up then that question of nature versus nurture. If you've all had the same upbringing, but if you respond to it differently, is it the basic genetics that do it to us, or is it the experience that does it to us?
I've got a buy-in here because we don't all have the same upbringing. I'm just thinking of my own family, and the massive difference between my sister's and my upbringing was my sister had an older brother. So it came into a family where there was already something established. It can never be quite the same.
And I'm one of four girls, and if the fourth girl had been a boy, I may not have been a doctor. My dad's a doctor. He wanted a doctor child. And if it had been a boy, I think the emphasis might have been on the baby rather than me.
But again, is childhood then the answer? Can we look back now that we are mature, aged individuals and account for it, given what's happened in childhood? Or how do we build the skills to overcome it? Or are we basically doomed forever to be victims of our childhood?
We're definitely not doomed forever, hence the psychotherapy. But look, I've met lots of people from really disturbed backgrounds who haven't had psychotherapy, but they've managed to reflect and make sense of their childhood because they wanted to be different. So, for instance, if you were physically abused as a child, particularly male, you're more likely to be abuser yourself. But many of children who were abused as children do not become abusers because they've reflected, because they didn't respond in that way to
but
their father.
Is that self-reflection skill part of your genetic upbringing, or is that a skill you acquire in life?
I think it's certainly more likely to have it if you've got a higher IQ. It tends to go with that, with problem-solving ability, but not always. Look, I think it's in both. I think that you come into the world with some capacity, and then your genetics kind of interplay with what you're exposed to.
One or two other shorter questions. We've got Max, and he's got a bit of a dilemma, Graham. The cure can kill him.
Yeah, we thought this was a very sharp way of contrasting physical and mental health, because they're both there side by side in the book. And here's a man who gets a stark choice. If he takes his lithium for his bipolar disorder, which keeps him stable, he's going to destroy his kidneys. And that will put him on dialysis, which may not be a long life. And, of course, his renal physician is saying, stop taking the lithium. And on Hannah's side, it's if you don't take the lithium, you will go mad, as it were. So that put the contrast very starkly on the page. And we did the same with Junji. He's thinking of suicide because his Olympic dream is being shattered by his shattered knee. And there's a big meeting to talk about it, the family and so forth. And the surgeon says, look, I'm not going to come along to that. It's all, you know, a bit touchy-feely for me. And Hannah says, well, you know, fair enough, but the knee isn't going to kill him.
But he also finds another focus which enables him to move forward. Another quick question. We've got Carey, who's one of the psychiatrists, and Kate Rigby. Each of these have their own concerns. How much do the concerns of the psychiatrist impact on the decisions and the judgments being made in treating patients?
I've got to say, we were here with you on the first book, and you said, you know, it's a big worry here. We've got this woman who's had multiple dates and seen different men. Her love life seems to be a bit unstable, and she's in this position of responsibility. And we said, she's 28. She's living a normal 28-year-old social life. There's nothing weird about it at all. But part of it is that you have young people with limited world experience in some cases, because they've been so focused on medicine, that who are making involved in decisions of literally life and death, requiring some significant philosophical and psychological underpinning for people in their 60s and 70s and 80s. This is an enormous weight.
But I would say the other thing is it depends on which ward and the physicians as to how much they're going to listen to the psychiatrists. And in some cases, there's a lot of respect, and psychiatrists are very much part of the team in the general hospital, but not always, as we highlight in this book as well.
Could the final answer be, and that by reading a book like The General Hospital, we've got an opportunity to reflect on our own situation?
We're hoping so.
Well, that brings the interview to a close. The third instalment is The General Hospital by Anne Buist and Graham Simpson, and it's a Hachette release. Graham, Anne, thank you very much for talking to me once again.
Thanks, David.
We'll just adjourn for a bit of a consultation in the green room.
Why have you come to talk to us, David?
Well, I've got this little problem. Oh, hang on, we're still on air. That was my little sort of ending to that interview, which was quite entertaining. Guess what, Jan?
Where are
you've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.